use your actually use your physical posture, your body, to start the meditation. That is the it's not only actually something we start the meditation, but the physical body is a very important instrument in Buddhist meditation. One uses again and again in various ways. There's various ways we can give attention to the physical body. But tonight we don't want to go into any kind of complex exercises, but keep it very simple. So as you sit here and you have your relaxed and upright posture, you can close your eyes if you like, but it's also fine to keep them open gently. Especially maybe if you're tired from work all day, and you notice, oh, if I close my eyes, I'm just immediately drifting off into oblivion, then keep your eyes a little bit open, just, you know, a smidgen. It's just like sometimes the Buddha images, they have, not sometimes, very often actually, the images we have from Asia, they have their eyes slightly open, they're not completely shut. Which is saying something, isn't it? We're here to be awake, very wakeful and alert to what is going on, starting with the physical side of our experience, with the physical body. How does it feel to be within your skin, so to speak, tonight? Is there anything which calls for attention? Do you have any areas which are maybe a little tense or tight or maybe even painful? But we're not, of course, looking for something negative or painful or unpleasant. It could also be the opposite. Huh? If you had a really, if you just come back from your holiday, haven't had to work yet, then you might feel very different. Your body might feel very energetic and rested. You don't find it difficult then to just give your attention to the task, the required task. To sense yourself as a physical entity. Notice the pressure you're experiencing with the surface you're sitting on. It might be the chair or the cushion. The sensations at the lower part of the spine. And then what one can do from the spine, one can go upwards the back of the body in a slow but continuously moving way, going up all the way. It's a bit like what you could call a body scan. You're scanning the sensations. In this way, acknowledging all the different parts which our attention scans over, starting at the bottom of the spine and then going up. And it doesn't matter what kind of sensations you notice, if they are on the pleasant side of the spectrum or the unpleasant side. We're not trying to have a particularly special experience. But really, what we want to do is we want to acknowledge, register, sense what we do experience. So it's a way of connecting with the immediacy of our human experience, using the body as an instrument. It's not a very, you know, high up in the sky spiritual exercise, isn't it? But it's very real, huh? Very tangible. And it's also a way of grounding ourselves, especially those of you who been mentally active all day, to ground yourself in the body. letting the scan come up at the back of your body, up the spine, but also besides the spine, left and right, sensing at one area after the other. And all the thought, if you have any thought activity, thoughts popping up, or worse, a complete thought stream uninterruptedly, which likes to engage you and take you in, then don't fight against your thoughts. We're not here to be completely thoughtless, but just now we're giving ourselves the directive to not giving the thoughts any attention. We're just letting them be as they are. They're quite happy looking after themselves. We don't need to get engaged and involved. And we're staying in the domain of the body. So once you've come up all the way, over the upper area of the back of the body, the shoulders, shoulder blades, maybe noticing some tension there, maybe not. We're not assuming anything or anticipating anything. It's very real, acknowledging what is here tonight. And then going way up, all the way up, via the back of the head, to the top of the body, top of the skull, top of the head. And then we do the same, we continue in the same way. But now we're going from there, we're going down to the front. You're going from the top of your head into the forehead, sensing. Now, of course, there might be more subtle sensations, especially when we are touching with our attention, we're touching the face, the forehead, and the left and right palate. We can get really, in this area, we can get really interested, you know, because we can notice sensations there which normally slip our attention in the course of a day when we're occupied with more coarser, more demanding things. And very often a lot of tension accumulates in the face. Then we go to the area just to where the eyebrows are, sensing the eyebrow region, and then in between the eyebrows. What the Indians call the third eye, that area. And the eye sockets, you can sense that. And even the eyes themselves. Just keeping at it gently, carefully, not using any force. When our attention drifts off, we just bring ourselves right back where we are, without any debate or discussion, sensing the nose and the nostrils, upper lip, and lower lip and the whole mouth. The tongue rests inside the mouth. And down to the chin. And finally to cover whole of the face, going up left and right jaw, right up to the ears, left ear first and then right, up to the right ear, cheeks, left and right cheek, and then before we move down into the torso, just sense for a moment the whole impression of your face. How does it feel now after you've been there on these various spots? What's the overall impression of your face right now? Releasing tension in the jaws if there's any. Of course, when I say releasing, I don't mean by an act of will, but just simply directing your attention there in a gentle way. And that very often is enough to just give it that little subtle movement of release. Some tension gets released. And then we move down from the face. Notice the front of the neck. It's important that this area is rather open, so your chin shouldn't be hanging down. You shouldn't contract here. This is a tendency many people have in meditation when they're tired. So keep your head up, so that you have an open feeling here in the front. Don't throw your head back also. That leads to dreamy states of mind. And then from there we kind of starting with the torso. First the very upper area, there where the collarbones meet. And then we're letting our attention first move to the left, along the left collarbone onto the shoulder. Just keeping going. And then the left arm down on the outer side. Just as if you are stroking yourself with your mind and with your attention. It's that kind of, you know, that kind of quality. It's not a kind of, you know, Thai massage with lots of pressure, but very gentle stroking. Right down into the fingers. And then coming up to the inner side, the palm of the hand, lower arm, the elbow bent, and then up again into the upper shoulder. And then just do this the same on the other side, move over to the right side. And now just do it yourself. Go down on the outer arm and come up on the inner. in this way, the shoulders might drop just that tiny little bit, which it needs to feel relaxed. Then we're coming, when we are back, up, we go to the center, there where the collarbones meet. And then from there we let the scan going, go down the front of the body, starting with the very top of the chest and then into the heart region and then further down. Also, it really helps to have a very benevolent, kind, overall attitude towards yourself. If you try to gain something or reach some imagined goal or state, then you tense up again. So this act of kindness towards yourself is no conditions, just simply relying on this very genuine, friendly, gentle form of attention. Goes all the way down over solar plexus, and reaching the belly area. Right down to the bottom of the end of the torso. And then we do the same with our legs, what we've done with the arms. We include also the legs as the last part to get completion of this body scan. And again we go down, we move on the outside of the left leg over the knee, the shin, then over the shin, down into the foot, top of the foot, again right into the tip of the toes. You can sense your toe, the toes one after the other. You can even sense your tiny little teeny weeny little toe, and then go to the soles of the feet and then come up on the inside. Feeling any pressure, sensations of solidity or whatever, and then moving over to the right side, doing the same thing. And then when you have done the right leg as well, you come back to the center, then to have a sense of completion, just sense for a few moments your whole body from the soles and from the tip of the toes to the top of your head. What does it feel like now after you've given your body this kind of attention? Just curious, just noticing any changes, very much the same, or whatever it is. We're still connected with this, we're sensing, feeling our corporeality. and all the mental impressions which might still be there, maybe even still a little bit demanding. We're still letting them be, not engaging. And for the rest of the meditation, you can either, you can do this again if you like, or you can focus on the lower belly area, there where you can clearly notice the movement through your breathing, the expansion and contraction of the abdomen. It's very noticeable, not difficult to find, but what's sometimes difficult is to maintain the attention. Now we have been moving through the body, and then to maintain the attention on one place, which is a next step, you could say. But no obligation. If you're happy to just do this body scan again, you can just do the same again on your own, in your own time, under your own directive. But if you want to be a little bit more focused and go to the lower breath body, the belly, where very clearly the sensations are noticeable of breathing in, the whole belly expanding, and then the turnaround to the exhalation, really letting them, following that exhalation right to the end. There's a very relaxing effect if we do that. And letting the new in-breath come all by itself. Don't have to do anything, don't we? The breathing happens automatically. But what is different to normal everyday breathing is that our attention, or we could also say our mindfulness, our awareness, is connected with this, with the feelings and sensations which are occurring whilst we're sitting here. Of course, when you're having from unusual long sitting still, pain arises, and first acknowledge the pain and consciously register what kind of pain it is, and then you might change your posture. It's not an endurance test where you have to grind your teeth. Always willing to bring yourself back. Note the inner voices might make comments, commentaries, criticizing yourself. That's totally superfluous. It's enough just to be willing to always direct oneself back. That in itself is very valuable. we're gently going against the grain of the worldly mind, always wanting to distract itself, wanting to be occupied with mental objects. But here we try to be content just with a sensing of the breathing, the body, something very rudimentary, and very good for us. And quite often the body gives us the signal that it appreciates it. The body likes to be treated in a kind way, in a compassionate way. Not be flogged like the old horses on the fields in the old days. Well, human beings have subtle ways of flogging themselves. Really being very gentle, very kind, very patient. Patient, to be patient is an act of kindness. And patience pays out in the long run. So I have thought, of course, in advance what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's not a spontaneous talk. Some of it is impromptu, but the theme I've chosen is the theme of contemplation, which is not, strictly speaking, Buddhist language, we could say. In fact, also what we were doing in meditation tonight is not really strictly Buddhist meditation. In fact, maybe just that last bit on the mindfulness of breathing, that's a very central Buddhist meditation, important Buddhist meditation, which even the Buddha continued to practice after his awakening. So we were in very good company tonight. In one discourse, some of you might be familiar with the Brahma Viharas, you know, those divine abidings, which they call the loving kindness, compassion, joy, appreciative joy, and equanimity. This is the classical way of portraying them. But a fifth one is actually the Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing, is also a divine abiding. It's a place where we can abide, where we can dwell inwardly, and we can get the sense that we're kind of lifted out of the mundane world of our thoughts and feelings and emotions, and dwelling in a divine abode, heavenly abode. Sometimes they're also called heavenly. But I don't want to talk about heaven tonight, even so some people might want to hear a bit more about it. The theme of contemplation is, to my view, actually a very central one. And also that's actually the way I have been trained by my teacher directly, Ajahn Sumedho, and also what I picked up from our primary teacher, Ajahn Chah, who really emphasized the aspect of contemplation. And in our European languages, contemplare, I think that's the Latin word, means to look at, and to look at something in a particular way, of course, not just, you know, to gaze and fixate. In fact, also I've heard that the old astronomers in the old days, they would practice something called contemplare templum. You know, they look at the sky, at the stars and so forth, and try to find certain laws and recurring configurations, and then they would maybe come to conclusions to establish a relationship between what was going on up there and what's going on down here on planet Earth. So later on, of course, it developed into astrology and so forth. We have these kind of things where the stars are contemplated, and then conclusions are drawn from that. But also, that's of course not Buddhist. That's another discipline. And we have in the Buddhist tradition, we have two terms which come up in the Buddhist teachings, where the word contemplation could be applied. One is the term in Pali, yoniso manasikara, it's called. You don't have to register that for those of you who are not familiar with Pali, it doesn't matter, it's just for me to trigger my memory. But yoniso manasikara is a very interesting term, because it means, manasikara actually means attention. And yoniso, there's the word yoni, which actually is the word for womb in Sanskrit and in Pali. So it's of course not meant in a literal sense, but more in a figurative sense, that you go to the source of things, and you put your attention to the source of things. So that, what is that, you know, in our experience, what is the source of things? And that's not an indication or a pointer to some kind of sublime mental experience, spiritual experience. That's actually more to look at our minds and look at the moments when things arise, when things manifest in our consciousness. And it can be very directed, very pointed towards one particular part. For example, this evening we didn't contemplate our body, but we looked at our body and we felt our bodies and got a little bit more in touch with it than we maybe normally do, or maybe we do it sometimes when we do the yoga exercises or other form of physical exercises. Then we give our bodies certainly very wholesome forms of attention. But the yoniso manasikara, so this going to the source, is more actually referring to the mind, to the mental states which are arising in our consciousness. And very often, of course, it's directly connected with the states of mind, emotional states, mental states, which cause problems for ourselves. Because that's, of course, the whole point of the teachings we have in Buddhism is to, and that's one way of phrasing it, is to liberate ourselves from any form of suffering, of stress, of discontent, even from the most subtle form of unsatisfactoriness in which we can experience in our lives. So that's not a small order, is it? We talk like that. If we just use the word suffering, then some people might find that a little bit too, negative or morbid. But if we draw this out and extend it, even the most subtle movements in the mind, where there's direction of wanting, of resisting, of moving against one's experience as it occurs in the moment, or a grasping and holding on when we have experiences which we agree with and we don't like them to disappear so quickly. It has to do with that area, and that's quite a big area of our experience when we are in a conflict, you could say. That's also a way of putting it, the ending of inner conflict, of inner division, the dividedness which we very often experience. Who doesn't know who doesn't have the experience of inner dialogues going on in the mind, at least now and then, huh? Every second Thursday or so it happens. But this is a very common human experience. And who is talking to whom? One could ask. Who is actually the one voice and who is the other voice? And why are there two voices talking to each other? What are they? What are they up to? You know, what is their intention? And actually, when we're looking closely, when we actually investigate what we are doing, we can very often we have to notice that actually there is no direction. There is not even a conscious intention. It's just kind of a habitual tendency we've picked up a long time ago and cultivated, nourished over a lifetime by giving inattention. This is called ayoniso manasikara. This is the opposite, unwise attention or unwise reflection. And in fact, one person has mentioned this is, one could compare to the expression, we are eaten by our own thoughts. We're consumed by our own thoughts all the time. I thought, that's quite something to it, huh? We're eaten and consumed by our own thoughts all the time. It just goes on and on and on and on. And somehow, we're involved in it. It's not a conscious choice. As soon as we have the directive, like tonight, to just focus on this, on the more grosser physical form, and leave the finer impressions, the mental impressions, emotional impressions, just leave them there, not suppress them, not resist them, just leave them there, where they are. Then we become aware of it, we become aware, there's a lot going on. I came in here, and it was just, I was talking to myself. And haven't even noticed until the directive was, okay, now, just put this down for the time being. You can pick it up later on. You get it back at the exit when you go out, at the latest. But most probably, of course, it will come early because it's very strong. This habit is very strong. And very often, of course, in spiritual circles, people then take the conclusion that because, it's very often perceived as unpleasant, we have to do something about it. We have to get rid of it, eradicate thought. And try desperately to become a meditator without thought. And the celebrating the experience of when it actually happens, when the mind finally shuts up, celebrating that, now finally. But then, you get up here and you walk out and you go to the bus stop or in your car, on your bike, and starts again, doesn't it? I mean, I don't want to dismiss that it's a good experience to have and to make, to see that there's also, of course, an experience of the mind without thought, that the mind can be very still at times. It's a wonderful experience. And there's even actually a lot of directives in certain forms of meditation. They call it the absorptions, where the mind eventually goes through various stages of deepening meditation when there's no thought activity. But that is not, of course, our subject for this evening, but also I wouldn't even suggest that as a subject for your life or, bringing a meditation practice into your life which really helps you to get a perspective on the way your body-mind functions. So, and if we are after special experiences or so, after stillness and silence, however wonderful that is, and of course it's absolutely allowable to enjoy it when it happens, but don't hang on to it, don't grasp it, don't invest too much emotional energy into it, because then again it will lead to discontent and a form of suffering, because we don't have this ultimate control of our minds. So with this investigation and inquiry or reflection on our experience, it brings a different angle, and then we're observing ourselves, what we are doing when we're actually going after a pleasant experience. We can witness that, how we do this, how much emotional energy is invested, how strongly we hold on, or very often, of course, the resistance. That is very, very common, that we don't like certain experiences, either because they're downright painful, like an unpleasant physical experience. Who likes that? Nobody likes that. We all appreciate pleasant experiences. But does it help to react with aversion if we have a physical pain even? But then the more tricky part is the mental pain, the pain coming from our thoughts, from our emotions. And some of them, they just come up sometimes out of the blue, a memory of a certain situation, of a person who said something to us which was challenging, hurtful, insulting maybe even. Memory of maybe an ongoing conflict, a kind of ongoing divorce or something. Some people, they have to work at that for years to come to terms with that, with those unpleasant experiences, unpleasant feelings and emotions. And very often people despair over it because of it's so unpleasant. Of course, they would like it to be gone rather today than tomorrow. But we can't put a time boundary on these things. That's really not what really helpful if you say, I want this to be finished by next week or next month. Things have their own rhythm and their own duration. And when we attend to it carefully, when we attend to it wisely and we investigate it, and first of all we open up for it, we even allow things into our consciousness, into our mental space, which are not flattering for our ego, for our ego self. Even then we say, okay, may it be here. Let me have a look at it. Is this something I want to hold on to? Definitely not. Maybe it's more something I'd like to resist and eradicate and wipe out. And the Buddha called this as one of the causes of suffering, is this wanting to eradicate, annihilate one's experience, whatever it is, be it a thought, unpleasant thought, feeling, emotion, physical sensations which are not agreeable, that's a form of desire. And those are forms of desires which are not productive, counterproductive to awakening. And bhava, the other one, is called bhavatana. It's a sense of becoming, always wanting to become something else, wanting to experience something else at what we're experiencing now. That's also a very strong habit. We all have this. And when it sometimes suddenly strikes us, we recognize that we're actually doing that, it's quite an eye-opener. I think, oh my goodness, I didn't know that I was doing this. For most of my life, I've been always trying to manipulate my experiences, my feelings, emotions, thoughts, and so forth. Except maybe in situations where I've just been swept away by a wonderful experience or so, and then we usually don't give that much attention. And that's also really not the point of the attention. We want to give that in wise reflection when we investigate our experience. It's not so much these extreme experiences, but more the humdrum everyday experiences. That's where we can actually become wise. We can learn something about ourselves. We can learn how we function, how we are structured, what is really real for us. So many people in spiritual circles, very often I notice they have a certain fantasy, what they want to get out of meditation or Buddhism or any other spiritual discipline. And it's very often based on denial of, or even suppression of, a big chunk of the experience as it happens to them on a daily basis. People sometimes think that with awakening they can avoid and sidetrack all the messy bits of ourselves, the things we rather not look at or avoid. Now we would like to kind of move into some kind of spiritual divine abode, the divine abode I was mentioning initially, to some divine realm, some heavenly realm, where we can bliss out and be comfortable. But you might have noticed in your life, very often the situations we learn a lot or learn most is when we're actually challenged. I've noticed that. When I'm challenged, I perk up, I sharp up. And it hasn't always been like that. Of course, there has been times early in my life when I didn't appreciate that. But now I do, actually. Sometimes I still have a bit of a wobble and a hesitation until I say, okay, this is now happening. This is obviously something to do with me. Let's give it all the attention it needs. Maybe giving it wise attention. Huh? Maybe giving it this yoniso manasikara. Go to the source of it. Where does this unpleasant feeling state come from? Is it coming from outside? Is someone else responsible for it? Can I blame someone else? Of course, one wouldn't do that after one has a little bit of, say, spiritual know-how or psychological know-how. Then one knows, well, blaming doesn't really work, does it? Blame someone else. That's a very unconscious way of going about things. If you blame other people for the unpleasantness which we experience right now, it can be still very inviting. It's not nice when someone shouts at us or insults us, of course. But actually, the responsibility, what we do with the impact of that, lies with us. It doesn't lie with the other person. It's only us. We have the responsibility of what we do with it. How we resonate with that. Or do we just react and call the other person bad names and curse them or wipe them out of a, never going to ever talk again with this person if she talks to me like that? Might still happen. But then, of course, some people, they take all the blame themselves. They blame themselves for all the unpleasantness they experience. It's probably my fault. Yes, this person is right, she called me that name because I'm a hopeless case. I deserve it. I'm really not a very good person. I lack in so many aspects. I lack in virtue, I lack in mindfulness, I lack in compassion, I lack in love, and I lack in equanimity. Lack. Some people can get very fault-orientated, the lack, concentrating on the lack of things, what's all wrong with them. It's a little bit better than blaming others, but just really very little, just a little bit. It's still pain, isn't it? Even if we blame ourselves for the dukkha, the suffering we experience, and then it's not much better. We're still blaming someone. And of course that leads us to a different area when we then can do look deeper. Well, who are we actually talking to? Whom are we blaming? Who is that? Is that just a fantasy image in our mind? Is it something real and tangible? Is it something which is exactly the same every day? Are there shifts? Is it some, is it different from day to day? Does it change regularly? Or how is our experience? Who are we actually talking to? And it seems that, the one who is talking changes, and also the one we're talking to is changing, isn't it? But definitely we're having the experience that this is happening to us, it's happening to me. So we take this very personally. That brings us closer to the crux of the matter, where the Buddha was very keen that we investigate that. And we're speaking about taking things personally. What do we actually mean? Who is that person? Who is that person beyond the name reality, the description we give ourselves, not just the name and the nationality and the gender and so forth, but all the other names we give ourselves? And there's a myriad of things we give ourselves, names in certain ways. And then there's the form element. There's the physical form, but then if we believe our thoughts, we give it mental form. We give ourselves mental form as well, and that creates our reality. But how reliable is that reality? Can we really build our house upon it? Can we trust that 100%? And the self-image, the self-view, as it's called, is a very important area to investigate. If we want to use this wise investigation, this going to the source of things, this yoniso manasikara, then it's really worthwhile to have a look at our self-view, who we think we are. Is the one who we think we are, is that really who we really are? Is that true? Is that who we really are? The you know, the images we have of ourselves and the perceptions we have of ourselves? Is that 100% reliable? If you think back over your lifetime, how much has it changed? You know, the images and the perceptions, the ideas you had of yourselves, how many times has it changed? I can look back, there's a myriad of changes happening. But there's always that sense, of course, this is happening to me, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's always happening to me. That's when how we speak to ourselves. But this me, even today, is a different one than yesterday, or even a few hours ago, sitting by the Lake of Geneva, relaxing in the warm sunshine. There's a different me than the me sitting right here now. But it's a very conventional, we call that conventional reality, relative reality. You know? This is certainly a place of that, to acknowledge that, to be conscious of that, what these different me's are like at any given moment in time. But if they change so frequently and they're so unreliable and they disintegrate so quickly, one after the other, then wouldn't it be a good idea to not take it so 100% or take it also so ultra seriously? And then, well, what, of course, the question one could now ask, well, what do we end up with if we don't take that so ultra seriously? What are we supposed to take seriously? And for that, of course, in spiritual teachings, and now in Buddhist teachings, that we have directives what to do besides this aspect of investigation and inquiry into to the source of things. It's, of course, the Buddha always recommended to have a wholesome attitude, a wholesome orientation in life, rather than an unwholesome one. That which leads to more brightness and more virtuous way of living one's life. And that, of course, brings us to, you know, very much the humdrum reality of everyday life, you know, that the highest spiritual goals, the highest spiritual aspirations can be connected with that which is happening in the humdrum of our lives, with our daily reality. Just the question is, do we try to squeeze in, or, you know, the meditation techniques, the Buddhist, maybe some Buddhist principles into the busyness of our lives, maybe even the convoluted reality of our lives? Or wouldn't it rather be better to do it the other way around, to adapt our lives, the way we live it, to the teachings, to the Dhamma, the Buddhist teachings, the recommendations we have there? That's very often why sometimes people wonder, huh? To take bits and pieces from spiritual practices they have learned, and try to put it in daily life, try to put it to practice, and wonder why so little changes over time, why so little gets transformed, why the heart quality stays more or less the same over years. But maybe just shift the whole thing. Maybe it needs a more fundamental shift of attitude, of orientation, so that the life as we're leading it needs to be more adapted to our highest spiritual aspirations and principles. I think that way there's more realistic, we can more realistically expect something to really change and shift, because we have our priorities clear, you could say, the spiritual principles. they are the highest priority. And of course, in Buddhism, we have certain ways how these principles are expressed and how they're explained. That we follow the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, for example, which is also in part which I was actually talking about tonight, just using different words. The teachings of the Buddha can be approached from many different angles and levels and so forth, but the Four Noble Truths are actually the central part of the teachings. The centrality of Buddhism actually goes around that. We're looking at our reality as it is. We're seeing, is there some sense of unsatisfaction and dis-ease or stress or frustration or life or not? If there is, can we fully acknowledge it without pretending it isn't there, without being too quick to shift and move and push away and resist and so forth? Just, you know, it's like this. This is my reality now. And then see, and when we investigate using this, again, this quality of investigation, and then we can have a close look. Well, how come? What's the reason? Why do I have this? Why do I have a heavy heart? Why do I have this oppression? Why do I feel so down and low in energy, so immobile, and why do I feel so frustrated? And then we look into it. We can find the causes through our investigation. But first of all, we need to be open for that first aspect, to squarely accept this is my reality in this moment. And if I really want to find a way of freeing myself from the oppression of dissatisfaction, of stress and so forth, then I have to look at the causes. And if I identify the causes and contemplate them and recognize them, then certainly I wouldn't reconfirm them, I wouldn't strengthen them. Certainly I would let them go. Say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not a masochist. I'm not here to potentize my suffering. I'm here to experience and realize and recognize more ease, more peace, more brightness and joy in life. That is actually what I'm in for. And so then the release happens. That's the third noble truth. This is the ending of it. Once we've identified the causes, then nothing can actually persist in the light of awareness, of consciousness, of mindfulness. Once we really fully have it there, then certainly this will disintegrate. And initially, when this faculty of mindfulness maybe is still very weak and undeveloped and not quite trained, then this will happen more frequently. But when this faculty is more trained and also goes together with the inquiry and investigation very well, then things just won't stick so much anymore. We won't just carry around negative thoughts and moods and emotions for days and days, or even for hours and hours. It has a kind of non-stick element to it. Just like the old Teflon frying pans, the food doesn't stick, so don't have to even use oil because it's of a special material which doesn't let the food stick to the frying pan. And the same with our mind. If we have this faculty really in operation mode, and then any difficult mental emotional states will still be touched, still acknowledge them, but they just don't stick, they just move on because we are receiving them as consciously and fully as we can and look after them. We don't resist them and we don't cling to them. And that's the way to freedom, to liberation. And then we have the fourth noble truth is about the Eightfold Path. And in a way, this is what, I don't know, there's not the time to go systematically through the Eightfold Path. There's also no need for it because speaking like this, the Eightfold Path actually is mentioned in indirect ways. The Eightfold Path is actually concerned of ethical attitudes, the general ethical attitudes, of course, in life. That's one, it's actually three sections of it. And the general orientation we have, the wisdom aspect, the wise and skillful inquiry, and then the latter parts, the last three, they have to do with our spiritual practice, the way we mobilize our energy using effort in a more rather balanced way rather than in a willful way, in a forceful way to eradicate the things we don't like. The Buddha used a wonderful image there with one monk who was a kind of very heavy meditator. He used to practice so much on the walking path that he was bleeding. His feet were bleeding. And when the Buddha saw this, he was asking him a question because he knew he was a musician before he became a monk. So he asked, well, how is it when you apply your energy and your effort in playing music, when you tune your instrument, when you overtune it, when you turn the knobs too much, how does that sound? Does it sound beautiful? And of course, you have to say no, it sounds horrible. Or if you don't turn them too much, the same, absolutely horrible sound. And in the same as the way we apply ourselves, ideally, should be a kind of balanced way of applying ourselves, coming from more balance. And that's not so much a physical energy, I'm talking about mental, emotional energy of a balanced approach. That we know actually how to use our attention. We even can recognize the quality of our attention. If our attention is rather, contractive and tight, or if our attention is more relaxed and open and gentle, and we have no agenda, we're not pushing and pulling, we're just giving it, we're giving our experience the attention, the awareness which it deserves and it needs. And then these three letter path factors, they come into place, and then awareness gets strengthened by it. And even the way that we are able to hold focus, because that's also something which needs for most of us a little bit of training, that we stay with our experience in a focused way, in a persistent way, willing to give it all the time of the world, not putting any demands on it, but be very willing to let a challenging mental state to be there, first of all. And if that's there, we have that kind of attitude, then we will see that the dukkha, the stress, which we repeatedly experience in our life, will first of all considerably lessen and get reduced, and eventually, when our skill, in a combination of giving this kind of special attention ourselves, going to the source of things, inquiring where are the causes for this, what I'm experiencing now? Why am I experiencing this now? And this why should not lead us to the head. It should not lead us to an analytical thinking about it. There's a time when the analytical faculty can come into play, but not when we are practicing Yonasya Manisikara. Then the qualities which come together is more the stillness of mind, the awareness, and the investigation, those three factors.